Welcome to this, the Monday edition of Closer Look. I'm Jim Burris.
And I'm Rose Scott. We begin with this. Traveling. Atlanta-based Delta Airlines says its operations continue to stabilize this afternoon, some 5 days after severe weather disrupted service and caused the airline to cancel more than 3,500 flights total. In a statement emailed to Closer Look, Delta spokesperson Michael Thomas says the carrier expects to operate more than 99% of its scheduled operations today. Delta started the day by canceling just 4 flights, although Thomas says a small number of residual cancellations are possible.
Now, that's in stark contrast to the weekend when the airline scrapped more than 550 flights. Delta says the extended delays are a result of last week's unprecedented severe storms, which grounded flights for hours in and out of Atlanta. In a statement to customers, Delta Chief Operating Officer Gil West said, quote, "When Delta doesn't fly aircraft, not only do customers not get to their destination, but flight crews don't get to where they are scheduled to be. When this happens, unfortunately, further delays and cancellations result, and flight crews can only be on duty for a limited time before rest periods are required by law."
And West goes on to say, quote, "While we can't control the weather, we understand the resulting recovery has not been ideal, and we apologize for that. Delta is offering affected passengers a travel waiver." But frustrated passengers continue to diss Delta, including this stranded passenger who told CBS News the carrier did little to accommodate him.
"I asked them, are you going to compensate for the hotel? No, we cannot do that, sir. I can only do a rebooking."
Former CNN talk show host Larry King tweeted, quote, "You won't believe it, but my Delta flight today got canceled because they didn't have a pilot."
Forbes travel contributor Laura Begley Bloom writes in a column posted on Forbes' website that Delta paid her, her husband, and her daughter, get this, a total of $11,000 to give up their seats on several flights. Now, that's actual cash, not travel credits. Delta is considered an industry leader when it comes to canceling flights. That could actually make affected passengers more angry, says Airline Weekly's Seth Kaplan.
Passengers, they'd hope for more from an airline that they, in many cases, have paid more to fly precisely because of how reliably it typically is.
Now, last year, Delta Airlines went 161 consecutive days without canceling a single flight.
And there's other news in the Atlanta area. There are leadership changes at Morehouse College. Friday, the Board of Trustees unanimously voted to immediately appoint an interim president. Now, John Wilson was expected to step down in the summer. That's not going to happen. Wilson is being replaced with the current chief operating officer of Morehouse, William Taggart, until a new president is identified and hired.
Also effective immediately, a new chairman of the Board of Trustees was appointed. Willie Woods takes that role. A statement from Morehouse College cites, quote, "actions which were taken based on recent feedback from the Morehouse community while adding new structure to the board that will help shape a brighter future for Morehouse College." This also comes on the heels of a news report from TheRoot.com, which cited anonymous sources detailing internal tensions within the all-male institution. Now, last week, famed Morehouse alum Spike Lee, Samuel L. Jackson, and Jay Johnson penned a public letter saying, quote, "Morehouse College is at present drowning in acrimony."
It went on to say, quote, "Student leaders feel they have no voice and are compelled to take you to court. The faculty has voted no confidence in your board chair. Your decision to not renew President Wilson's contract is inexplicable, and you must now search for the school's third president in 10 years. Goes on to say, quote, "All of us in the Morehouse family, students, faculty, and alumni, hold you, the trustees, responsible for this dismal state of affairs." Close quote. Again, that letter coming from Morehouse alum Spike Lee, Samuel L. Jackson, and Jay Johnson calling for a shakeup in the college leadership. This is Closer Look.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Jim Burris.
And I'm Rose Scott. As commuters all around the city think about alternative travel following the partial collapse of the I-85 bridge, here's some news. Atlanta's bike share is expanding, and in a big way. Bike share is expanding from 100 bikes at 22 stations to, get this, 500 bikes at 65 locations. But for all those extra bikes, has the city really seen an increase in ridership? The official launch is next Wednesday, but in studio with us now is Atlanta's chief bicycle officer, probably one of the coolest titles you can get, Becky Katz. Becky, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Did you ride your bike over?
I did. I took MARTA to Lindbergh Station and then rode down Piedmont Road.
You rode under the bridge?
I did.
Well, talk about planning. and timing. When Atlanta's bike share first launched last summer, the plan was always to expand, correct?
It was. So the first launch of the 100 bikes was really a demonstration phase. We really wanted to see what Atlantans would respond to on bike share, what the issues would be, and then scale from there. So we learned a lot through the demonstration phase, and we're really excited about this next launch.
Are you on schedule, though, with this expansion? So you're on schedule.
We are on schedule. The original plan was to be all done and wrapped up in 2014. But since then, we reevaluated when I was hired. And at this point, we're right on schedule. And we're also looking forward into the future of, since T-Splos passed, to another expansion and having that all wrapped up in the next 2 years.
And we'll talk about that in a moment, but I want to step back to something you just said, and that is during this kind of trial phase, you all learned a lot of lessons. Highlight some of those for us.
Yeah. So one, we found that lots of people love to ride. So that's really great. We had over 2,000 people ride the system. They took over 8,000 trips and many, many miles. And so we learned that bike share is for Atlanta, that it works. What we also learned was that the pricing structure wasn't a perfect fit. We got a lot of critique about how much it cost, how to use it, and all those types of details. And so we've actually gone ahead and updated the pricing structure. So if you go to relaybikeshare.com right now, you can see that we've introduced some new pricing, we've lowered the cost, and we hopefully have made it more accessible to more Atlantans.
During this trial phase, were you seeing a shortage of bikes? In other words, was the demand for those available outpaced by the supply of available bikes?
I would actually change that question a little bit. We actually saw bikes being locked all outside of stations. So, right, our bike share system uses Sobi technology, which allows you to block the bikes to any public bike rack. But you do incur a small fee. And we saw the bikes just going everywhere and being locked out of station. So we really saw a demand to expand our station infrastructure and to grow the amount of bikes and stations throughout the city of Atlanta.
You mentioned that you all changed your pricing structure. So are you saying that folks were saying, hey, this is a little bit too much, or how can you guys, you know, justify this amount?
Yeah. So one, the cost to entry was $8, and that was in a pay-as-you-go plan. So you got 60 minutes, and then you would be charged per minute after that. We heard a lot of feedback that that was too high of a starting point. That should not be the lowest cost of entry. So we have now done a pricing plan where it's a pay-as-you-go, but you only have to purchase 30 minutes, and that's at $350, and then you're charged per minute after that. We also heard a lot from locals that they'd like an annual pass, so where you pay on a monthly basis, but you get a discount for committing to 12 months. So now we have a pass that is $10 every month and $120 for the year.
What about critiques on the bikes themselves? Do people like the bikes? Do they want bigger bikes, faster bikes? What did you hear?
Everybody I've talked to loves the bikes. Everyone is always like, those blue bikes, I've seen them or I've ridden them and they're great. You know, even when you ride regularly, typically a lot of Atlantans don't ride this Dutch style step through bike that our bike share bikes are. You know, there's no chains, there's no grease, there's an integrated bell, and it's just so much fun.
A fun bike.
It really is.
I want to go back to the prices you just mentioned. So from the low of $3.50 per 30 minutes to a high of $120 a year if purchased in 12-month increments, where are you seeing kind of on that spectrum most people fall in?
So in terms of what we're seeing right now in terms of user fees, about 50% of user fees come from pay-as-you-go members, and about 50% come from people purchasing monthly plans. We expect that to be slightly adjusted as we expand into more of our single family home neighborhoods and have more density of stations and are touching more communities. So I think we're open to finding out, you know, again, and always looking to people to give us feedback so we can continue to adjust and modify the pricing structure and the system as a whole based on the feedback that we get.
And you know who the biggest users of the bike share are? Are we talking, you know, in-town commuters, tourists, students? How does that break up?
So I think a lot of different people are using the system. It's hard to say, is it a commuter or a recreational cyclist? We truly try and focus on just getting people to use the bikes for whatever reason. But what I can tell you is that the average ride is about 11 minutes. And that the most popular times that we see the bikes being ridden is at 12 p.m., around 12 p.m. lunchtime during the week, about 5 p.m. in the afternoon on all days, and then Saturdays throughout the day. So I think you can make some assumptions about who's riding at 5 and who's riding on the weekends, but generally we've just seen a lot of use across the board.
The voice you hear is Becky Katz. She is Atlanta's chief bicycle officer. You know, we've talked about this on Closer Look before, which is having this the bike expansion available for all neighborhoods, for all populations. And there has been some focus on trying to get more bicycle share programs, getting more people of color involved, particularly on the West End. What can you tell me about that?
So we did do a number of amazing programs with a lot of different partners, including Red Bike and Green, We Cycle, Urban Perform, and the Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, along with a ton of just regular neighborhood outreach. We started a Westside Champions program where we hired 10 Westside residents. And what we have seen has been an amazing response from the Westside and from people of color. It's just been so amazing, especially because Atlanta, in a majority minority city, we need the system to represent, you know, our communities as they are right now. And so what we're seeing is that with the limited amount of hubs that we have on the West Side currently, 9% of our rides are starting from the West Side.
So that amazing response, that's what you're talking about. You're seeing more people getting involved. Now, there was some concern about the payment portal here, mm-hmm. because there are some folks, regardless of color, who are unbanked or underbanked and may not have a debit card or a credit card. What are y'all going to do in terms of that?
That's a great question. So one, we have actually started an additional plan for low-income community members. It's going to be $5 a month. There's already information up on the new website for that. But that does not solve the question you asked, which
sure.
is the unbanked. And so there has been a big push to solve the cash payment system, and we have not yet solved it, and we're working on it.
Is there a way somehow that you all are looking at working with MARTA that you could put this service on the Breeze card? Because often some people who bike may also take MARTA.
We are exploring that, and we have a really great relationship with MARTA. There are some challenges with the payment infrastructure they use and the proprietary information, but we are working with them because we do think that that is a fabulous way to solve some of the issues.
While we're talking about money here, let's talk about the cost of expansion. How's that being funded?
So right now at the 500 bike level, it is being fully privately funded through CycleHop, our private operator. And we received a very large, awesome supporting sponsorship from Georgia's own credit union, who committed to funding the system for 5 years.
Talk about then what the user fees go to pay for.
So the user fees go to pay for the operations. You know, the biggest cost of bike share is the staff. We have 6 full-time staff members. They operate out of a warehouse on the West Side, along with they have a conference room and office and switch yards.
Now, you all have some new stations coming on board here. But when you do that, you also have to look at planning in terms of infrastructure. Some areas have bike lanes. There are mm-hmm. some neighborhoods that don't have bike lanes. How are you all tackling that?
So we actually have a lot of data about where people ride currently from previous studies like Cycle Atlanta 1.0 and other observations of where people are riding. So even in communities that have less bike infrastructure, we try and orient the stations to those local neighborhood streets that even without bike infrastructure, you feel safe riding. And then we looked at topography and what's the flattest streets. So we did try and create a system where when you get on a station, you can get on at least one road that you feel safe. And then it all goes hand in hand. I mean, bike infrastructure and better quality bike infrastructure is incredibly important to the success of bike share.
Well, and safety, as you know, tragically, there have even been some deaths as it relates to pedestrians, bicyclists, motorists. Can you assess how the city of Atlanta is handling all of that, though? Because you also have to work with the transportation department on that.
Yeah, and that's definitely another huge part of my job. And the City of Atlanta's Renew Atlanta team, the TSPLOS team, and Public Works has a huge focus on installing much safer infrastructure going forward for all users of the road.
Have you all seen an increase in reports of bike-related injuries because of the bike share program?
We have not. We have had zero reported injuries on the bike share. And this is true across the country. Bike share, I think because of the style of bike and how heavy they are and how alert you are when you ride them, it has been safer across the country in every city. And that's like in Chicago and New York, who have millions and millions of rides under their belt.
That probably comes as a surprise to many listeners. Does it come as a surprise to you?
Again, I think when you get on one of those bikes, you're like, oh yeah, this feels safer because of the upright nature of the bikes. And again, they're much heavier bikes than what you're used to riding. They're bright blue. And even I feel safer when I ride the bike share bikes.
So you ride the blue, the very, very, very visible blue bike?
Oh, I ride Relay all the time. You know, sometimes I take Marta to work and then don't have my bike with me, or I'm going to a place that I then want to take Marta after, or I want to walk to the next place. So it's great because I don't have to worry about the bikes. I ride it, I drop it off, and then I go to my destination. I don't have to worry about picking up my bike or what I'm going to do with my bike. Maybe I want to get in an Uber after to go further. So it is awesome to have bike share even in my personal life.
Becky, as we wrap up, let's talk about your position. Not many cities have a bicycle chief officer, but your position was funded, I think, through another grant or another entity. So where are you now with this? Are you officially part of the City of Atlanta government structure here?
Yeah, so I was always officially part of the City of Atlanta's staff. My funding is partially from the Arthur Blank Family Foundation and Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, which we're very thankful for. But the mayor committed to continuing to all the funding that is necessary to keep my position.
Any concerns with the new mayor coming in that it could be eliminated?
I sure hope not.
Just out of curiosity, you mentioned that you rode underneath the I-85 bridge where it used to be anyway, coming in from the Lindbergh-MARTA station. Are you all seeing an increase just in the past week of riders who are looking for a commute alternative?
So that's a really great question. We've seen an increase of bike ridership this month generally, but it also could have a lot to do with the weather. So we didn't have bike share last April, so we don't have numbers to compare to see if we actually have an increase. But we have had an increase in bike share, bike ridership this month.
We've been talking about Atlanta's bike share expansion with the city's chief bicycle officer, Becky Katz. And that program's expanding to 500 bikes at 65 locations. As always, good to see you. Thanks for coming
Thanks,
in.
Thanks, Becky.
Yeah.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Jim Burris.
And I'm Rose Scott. It may feel a lot longer, but actually it hasn't been since all of this happened.
I heard a big pop, and I thought it was like a car accident or something outside.
The most amazing thing was the flames coming up and igniting the power lines. I've never seen power lines catch on fire before.
Essentially, y'all, the cork has just been put in the bottle. Think about one of the major arteries that comes in and out of this city, where folks move north and south through our state. A chunk of it has just been taken out of play.
This incident, make no bones about it, will have a tremendous impact to travel. We commit to you that we will have this as open just as soon as possible, but please be patient.
So my message to everyone is get your MARTA maps out.
Well, the leftover debris has now been removed and repairs are underway. Commuters, transit riders, school bus drivers, bicyclists will all continue to play this game. How can I get there and how long will it take? Meanwhile, state and local agencies are working together to help figure it out, and that includes the State Road and Toll Authority, where Christopher Thomason is the executive director and board secretary. He joins us now in studio. Director Thomason, welcome.
Well, thank you.
How was your commute over to the station?
The commute wasn't too bad. We got a little worried as we got closer to the site of the construction, but made that turn right before it.
you know, years from now, the question of where were you the day the I-85 bridge collapsed might be asked of you. What will you say?
I was actually working underneath the Gold Dome, and before the night was over, I was on scene at that first press conference with Commissioner McMurray and Colonel McDonough.
In all the years you've been in transportation, had you ever seen anything like this, a portion of the highway collapsing, and especially due to a fire?
Never seen anything quite like this, and this really goes to, was not something that you can normally plan for. Certainly, no one anticipated it, but I'm very proud of how we've been able to quickly react. That happened Thursday evening, and by Friday, we'd already made some changes and added additional express bus service. And as you can see from the work, the demolition's complete, and we're moving into the construction phase.
So there are a lot of agencies kind of working on this complex picture. Talk about how CERTA is involved in solving and working towards a solution until we get that bridge back up.
So at CERTA and also at Greta with the express buses, we are involved with two components. One are the I-85 express lanes, and the other is the Greta Express service, those large commuter buses that come from the suburbs of Atlanta and bring people into the work zones of either downtown and midtown. So for us, what was key was what could we do to help provide commuting options other than cars, and how are we going to reroute around I-85? And we did that by doing two primary things. Coming up that night with our detour routes around I-285 and I-20, and adding MARTA feeder service, but going from our park and rides to provide a direct link into the MARTA rail system.
And in fact, the the HOT lanes were designated as, three or more riders in one vehicle and transit only the day after that. How effective was that choice?
Right. The day after, so that Friday, we did HOV 3+ only mode, which means for one of the first instances, you even if you had a Peach Pass, if you did not have three or more people or you weren't public transit, the lane was not available. And we did that to give priority to the transit routes. It was effective, but there was so much traffic in the general purpose lanes that it was hard for the buses to get all the way into the lane and all the way back out.
Have you all considered extending that and having that just kind of the standard rule until the bridge is repaired?
We considered extending it, but because most of the traffic is detouring around 285, that is fairly north of where the problem is. So we've gone ahead and gone back to the standard practices for the lane. I'll say this, though. If we were able to have a higher frequency of transit vehicles, it is something that we could consider again in the future.
You know, you all are known as the, quote, transportation financing arm for the state of Georgia. So with this disruption in travel on I-85, is there a financial impact that you all are having to deal with here?
There's certainly a financial impact to the state. But for what we're doing, the financial impact is really around the additional costs of doing this additional service, as well as the costs that come from the longer detour route. The bus drivers, the buses, they're on the roads longer. We're spending some more on fuel. And, of course, the additional service, we may hit a point where we need additional bus operators to maintain the levels of service that we have in place.
That night, I want to go back to that night of March 31st and all the agencies having to come together. How late were you guys up in trying to figure all this out?
We were on scene, and I did not get back to downtown till about 1:30 in the morning. But in many ways, I had it easy. The engineers at the Department of Transportation, they've been working pretty much nonstop, and they had initial plans drawn up by that Sunday. It really was incredible to watch them at work. And there have been people, either construction crews, engineers, certainly communication folks, that have been working around the clock since March 31st.
I want to step back to something you just mentioned, and that's the added cost as buses potentially have to take longer routes and it's slower to get there than normal. How much are you all forecasting this could cost?
We're trying to pull that together now. Right now, I don't have a forecast. I will by the end of this week. And part of the reason for that is last week was not a normal week. It was spring break weekend. So Even that Friday, so many people were able to stay home or they were already starting their spring break vacations. Last week, normally we would have seen about a 20% dip in ridership, yet we saw our ridership numbers stay around the same. So for us to try to calculate and project those future costs, it's all about the data that we're going to gather this week.
You also talk about the need potentially for more bus drivers. I mean, that doesn't sound like something you can just scare up pretty easily. There's training involved, certification. How do you all go about solving that problem?
Well, there's a twofold approach. We are actually able, with our contractor, to bring in drivers from out of state who are fully trained, have their commercial driver's licenses. And for the MARTA feeder service, where they're going from the park and rides just to the MARTA station and back, that point-to-point service, we should be able to quickly get up to speed and bring extra drivers to do that service and keep our regular drivers doing their normal routes.
The voice you hear is Christopher Tomlinson. He's the executive director and board secretary for the State Road and Toll Authority. And, you know, people say, look, June 15th, it cannot get here fast enough. But this collapse brought attention to an ongoing concern as it relates to transit issues in this region and even in the entire state. One elected official said, quote, it exposes the underlying issue of the lack of a cohesive and comprehensive transportation plan. You agree with that? Were y'all, as everyone involved, all the stakeholders, were y'all exposed here?
I don't think that we're exposed. To me, it sort of highlights what are we doing currently to work together in a seamless fashion, but it's also helping us identify what are the things that we can do to improve it. And I'll give you an example. All of us are already on our speed dials of our cell phones. I was talking with Keith Parker that evening and other officials. We were able to coordinate what we were doing, bringing more riders directly into the MARTA rail service. But going forward is bringing up questions for us like, you have our website, you have MARTA's website. How can we make it that much easier for people to find information on how to make all these connections? So we're going to leverage this situation to make further improvements to make it easier for people to understand all the different options that exist.
So is that the biggest lesson learned in terms of having a more cohesive communication with the other transit agencies?
Well, I think the communication's there, but making the service seamless. I'm a big believer that when it comes to government, there should be no wrong door. Someone should not have to figure out the alphabet soup of CERTA, GRETA, MARTA. You want to be able to walk out your door and get to your final destination, and there's certainly areas where we can make that more seamless.
CERTA is the agency behind the HOT lanes, which we spoke briefly about a moment ago, the ones where you have to have the Peach Pass and the rates are variable depending on traffic. Are you all seeing an uptick in how much it costs to ride along those HOT lanes because of this added congestion?
Actually, last week, rates were down from their typical level. I really want to thank the public. I think people took advantage of the situation to look at teleworking or staying at home or using transit. And that translated to less cars on the road, of course, coupled with spring break last week. This week, again, we'll tell and we'll see what the rates are. And that's information we'll be able to provide to you or anyone else.
And this may be preliminary based on what you just said, but are you seeing an increase in toll-exempt trips, those who can use the HOT lanes without having to pay?
I haven't seen an increase yet. I haven't seen that yet.
June 15th, as I mentioned, can't get here fast enough. How optimistic are you that that date will be met?
I'm optimistic. The Department of Transportation wouldn't put out a date that they didn't have confidence in. It's all about the weather from this point out.
And so you're also playing meteorologist, hopefully.
Well, we deal in a lot of forecasts, but I had the opportunity to get closer to this than most people. And there are some really good people working really hard to make these repairs. And if I've heard the reporters talking about it. It's amazing to see the stage they're at. Demolition is done. We're in construction. And so I'm confident that we're going to hit that June 15th date.
the supports already going into place. I couldn't believe that when I drove by this weekend. Something to see for sure. Yeah. I want to ask you, June 16th, does your job go back to normal? Is it business as usual? Or is this something that's going to leave a lasting impression on how you work?
This is definitely something that's going to leave a lasting impression in how we work. Like I said, June 16th, what I hope happens is we're out of the triage mode and coming up with temporary fixes, and we're into the planning mode of long-term fixes based on the lessons learned. And that gets back to how can we make it more seamless. This is something that the transit community has been working on for quite some time. This is something that puts it on everybody's radar, and it takes it from something we were doing in a sort of more quiet fashion to something that is in the forefront. And for me, I think that's a good thing.
1 week from today, you're on the agenda to present at SRTA's board meeting. That includes a briefing to board members on the response to the bridge collapse. What do you plan to tell them?
Well, we're going to tell them what we've heard from our customers. What are some of the calls that came in? What was the volume of calls that we dealt with on those first days? Because that, too, is part of the lessons learned. It's all about the customer feedback. We as transportation professionals, we can never lose sight of the fact that there's customer-facing services, and we may not always see it the same way as a typical customer. And that's what I'm going to talk to them about.
Chris, as we wrap up here, last week volume was not the same as this week. In fact, more volume. So at the end of this week, you all will come together, take a look at what happened, what didn't happen, and then could we see some changes next week?
Yeah, potentially. We're already seeing that it's been very popular both last week and even this morning with these MARTA feeder routes, these special routes that go from the park and rides right to the rail stations. We want to make sure we have adequate capacity on those. You've heard MARTA talking about park and ride challenges and parking spaces. We're looking at the utilization in our parking lots to see if there's other opportunities for additional people to park there. And then we will go ahead and we'll continue to tweak plans. We believe that what we put in place is being effective, but again, we know last week was not a typical week.
Christopher Thomason is executive director of the State Roll and Toll Authority. We've been talking about easing congestion while repair work is being done on I-85. Thanks for coming in and taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good to talk to you.
Everybody sing. Closer Look continues here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I am Rose Scott.
And I'm Jim Burris, and you're listening there to Atlanta's own Gladys Knight and the Pips singing their version of the Sesame Street theme song.
I like that.
For almost 50 years now, Bert, Ernie, and more recently Elmo and the crew have been teaching children about their 1-2-3s and ABCs. Today, your kid's favorite block saw the debut of a new character. Meet Julia.
Boing.
Elmo sees Julia is playing with a stuffed rabbit.
Fluffster.
Yeah, Fluffster's Julia's favorite toy, right?
That there's Elmo playing with Julia, who is the first character on Sesame Street to have a developmental disability. Julia is on the autism spectrum. Here to talk more about Julia and the importance of featuring such a character is Jeanette Betancourt. She's the Senior Vice President of U.S. Social Impact with Sesame Workshop. That's the company that produces the show, and she joins us by phone from New York City. Welcome to Closer Look.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julia has already been featured in Sesame Street's online videos and storybooks. So why did Sesame Workshop decide to bring her to the TV screen at this point anyway?
You're right. We first launched our Sesame Street and Autism, The Amazing and All Children initiative for giving information about acceptance and understanding around autism, and that was in October 2015. And there was a wonderful storybook included in that that was really the emergence of Julia And we heard such positive feedback from the general community as well as the autism community to bring her to life. And we responded.
Sesame Street has a history of talking about issues like death, bullying, racism. Now you add in autism. How did Sesame Street producers decide how to talk about this in an age-appropriate way?
Absolutely. We often heard from the autistic community this concept that when you see one child who has autism, you've really seen only one child with autism. And so we were aware of that. And for Julia, we wanted to make it her unique autism features and characteristics. And we just built her in what would be typical of a four-year-old. And she has wonderful aspects of curiosity, but also some things that make her slightly different.
And Jeanette, in developing Julia's personality, do you all reach out to, I guess, experts or counselors? And what resources did you all look to in developing Julia's character?
Absolutely. We were very careful and know that we need to reach out in different ways. So we had a cadre of 14 organizations and advisors guiding us along the way, not only for the first phase, but also the development of Julia, as well as also hearing from families who had autistic children, as well as those that had, again, typically developing children. We wanted feedback from advisors as well as on the ground.
So tell me about that feedback. What did you hear?
Oh, my goodness. One, we heard how amazing, and excuse the pun, it is to develop not only Julia as a character, but also the entire initiative and the scope that we selected, which is focusing on understanding and acceptance. That we heard from so many, particularly families who had autistic children, saying, oh, now our children feel that they're not alone. Now they have a wonderful character that they could also relate to.
A moment ago, you mentioned that Julia, in some ways, is a little different. And as we mentioned, autism is a spectrum disorder. So given that, how did the producers decide which traits of autism Julia would specifically exhibit?
Yeah, so we did a lot of vetting on that and careful consideration. Again, we did not want to seem that Julia represents all children who are autistic. At the same time, we did select certain characteristics that may identify her as being autistic more overtly, and that included avoiding eye contact and maybe not being as verbal. She does use a communication device, as well as when she gets anxious or excited, she has more what we call flapping or steaming of response. And those seem to be things that were related often at times for autistic children.
For those of us who might have missed this morning Sesame Street, talk about how the other characters interact with Julia. Do they seem at all aware of her autism?
Oh, it's a wonderful story because it's really from the perspective of kids and the kind of questions and responses that we heard. So she has her Sesame Street friends, and she has Alan and Abby and Elmo who already know her. But then Big Bird comes in, and he hasn't met Julia quite before. And at first, because she doesn't look at him and doesn't quite respond immediately, Big Bird thinks that she doesn't want to be friends. And so Alan and her Sesame Street friends explain she has autism. She does things a little differently, but also she does many things that they can do all together. And that's such a wonderful story.
And Jeanette, prior to Julia making her debut on the Sesame Street via the screen, did you all preview this episode with parents, with those that work with kids on the autism spectrum to get their feedback?
We do what we usually do with our programming, and keeping in mind also that we initially did all of the research I described beforehand, mm-hmm. especially with the storybook. But in this case, we do what we call storyboarding, and that is bringing the concept of the story or the script into actually childcare programs and seeing young children's reactions and questions and perceptions. So again, we really believe that we need to be out there and testing and hearing from children and adults alike.
You know, your title, the Senior Vice President of U.S. social impact with Sesame Workshop. What does that entail? Does it really focus on such things like having a new Muppet like Julia?
What it entails is a wonderful part of Sesame Street that I think often people don't hear about, and that's what we call our community and family engagement work, which is actually philanthropically funded. And we take special topics that often are not, there's not a lot of resources. So we've done, obviously, this work. We've also done work around children of incarcerated parents or military families or food insecurity here domestically, and all resources that are freely available.
You just hit on my next question, which was a follow-up. I remember when you all introduced someone who had a parent who was incarcerated.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was part. And again, as you heard from what we did with autism, similarly what we did with incarceration, we found that there were such limited resources in explaining incarceration of a parent, but more importantly, reducing the stigma about talking about such a impactful event in any family's or children's lives. And so we create these resources, again, based on research to, again, make them available.
And this may seem like a simplistic question or even an obvious one, but why? Why is it essential to do this?
We feel our mission as an organization is, and as a nonprofit organization, is to help all children become smarter, stronger, and kinder. We want them to really grow in all their areas of development. We also know those early years are so important. So we also know that there's many issues that young children face nowadays that often don't get addressed overtly. And so we feel very strongly that this is an opportunity to make a meaningful difference in the lives of all children, but especially those that may be more vulnerable.
In fact, this is the first time in 10 years a new character has been featured on the show. Will other characters like Julia be introduced onto Sesame Street, perhaps a Muppet who is physically disabled or a transgender Muppet?
All wonderful questions. And the thing I think that people often forget is, believe it or not, in 2 years, in 2019, we'll experience our 50th birthday, our anniversary. And throughout our history, we've actually demonstrated different abilities and disabilities on our programming. Everything from cognitive challenges to visual and hearing impairment and to physical disabilities as well, but always from the point of view not on what makes that different, but more importantly, that inclusion approach, what we can all do together.
A lot of those have been, though, in characters played by children or adults, humans, mm-hmm. so to speak, and less so by Muppets. The actual characters make up Sesame Street, who live on Sesame Street. There's a difference there, and that's why I asked that question.
Yeah, and that's a good question in terms of the Muppets that we use. One of the things that we are really emphasizing is, as you heard in our research and our focus, is we want to do this well. And we want to do it with the end goal that not only Julia, but that whole concept of the amazing in all children is reflected throughout all organizations and systems where these resources could be available. So we really want to pay very, very close attention and use Julia and this concept around autism for a while longer before we delve into others, because we want to do this justice.
And Jeanette, you know, Sesame Street, you all have curriculum and goals and resources for teachers and parents. Have you all also had to do this for introducing Julia and how to talk to your students or your young children about Julia?
Absolutely. And part of all of this, today was the debut of the episode on HBO and PBS and on YouTube. But all of these resources, including that wonderful episode, are all available at sesamestreet.org/autism, and is available also as an app at Sesame Street and Autism, so that we can, again, use these resources and the context in different settings and how to use them very effectively. And everything is in that site or that app.
And Jeanette, as someone who grew up on Sesame Street, I think we all in this studio have. And I got to tell you, your job sounds really kind of cool.
Well, I have to say it is kind of cool. I love working here. And each of these efforts just seem like such an opportunity to make a difference. But we could only do it, again, not because we were on the radio together, but people as yourself who help spread the word about all of these resources and content that we have that others can use.
Y'all need a Muppet with some locks, some long locks, you know, and some Muppets in public radio, you know, and then get a Muppet that, well, you have ginger Muppets because Jim's a ginger, so, but get a Muppet with some locks.
You know what? There was actually a wonderful episode a while back, which it was all about hair, and there was a Muppet with locks.
I missed that.
Yes. And it was really, again, the same kind of theme, how we may all have different hair and it comes in different styles and different lengths. But again, we all share this wonderful thing with our hair, styling it, loving it.
Absolutely.
I want to step back to Julia as we wrap up here. What's going to be her role on the show? Is she going to be a character that we see week after week, day after day?
No, she will be a character who does come in. Again, we feel very strongly we have our wonderful Muppets that for young children, it's important to see the consistency and routine. She will be on a couple of episodes this season as well as the following. But more importantly, her role is not always centered around her autism, but as part of her Sesame Friends.
We've been speaking with Jeanette Betancourt, Senior Vice President of U.S. Social Impact at Sesame Workshop. The company produces Sesame Street, and we've been discussing its newest character, Julia, who falls on the autism spectrum. Jeanette, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And you, can learn more about Julia. You can visit PBA.org to watch a video about how she was created and how schools are using her in the classroom. That's PBA.org/Julia. Awesome.
I'll have to take in an episode.
There you go.
Well, that's it for today's show. Closer Look was produced by Candace Wheeler. Ebony Lemon and Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Executive producer, Christine Dempsey. A big thanks to the entire WABE News team.
And we're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.